Contain.
Good evening, good afternoon. This is Eric, and we're getting into the second part of this series. Now, I kind of feel like a bit remiss on the first title, Cybernetics of the 21st Century. I think that's kind of actually not the right word. And we're going to get a little bit into, I already sort of mentioned why cybernetics as a field of research and studies failed in the 20th century, but I didn't actually get into the etymology of the word and exactly why it's a bad word to describe what somebody like Yukhui is even trying to explain. And he gets a little bit into this as well. He did an interview with Geert Loving a few years ago where he talks about, and he talks a lot about this in Cosmotechnics too, how in the Mandarin language there aren't really the same words for technological development as there are in the Western sense. And he brings in Heidegger a lot to sort of illustrate this example. And even Heideggerians have even said that there's like, when it comes to a Western imposition of technology or whatever you want to call it, techne, that's the theory cell version, there's always like this sort of like hidden latent undertone of, I don't know what you want to say, like Western imperialization or imperialism or something like that. And they hint at this, and Yukhui kind of like locates it at the level of logos or of language itself. So this is kind of an episode on non-cybernetics, other cultures in the 20th century who were doing things similarly to cybernetics. We could talk about Claude Shannon and von Neumann, and also game theory, how especially in Russia they were developing, because at first they thought cybernetics was like sort of like a bourgeois pseudoscience or something like that, where they're like, it's materialist and idealistic at the same time. You know, it sort of puts humans, because what it does in the sort of like Benjamin Bratton sense is you're looking at humans, or the neo-rationalists or something, is like you're looking at humans as like simply cogs in this system that doesn't offer what Marx actually wanted, which is to liberate humans from the machinic practice itself. or what sort of anybody, like, this is the problem with like all of these technocrats, is they don't see humans as having any sort of value outside of the function that gets recuperated by these machinic processes. They don't see humans as being like, I want to chill, I want to hang out, I want to make art, I want to do fucking whatever, you know? Like, they don't see that at all. And what I want to sort of get at is maybe like at least just examining certain ways in which people had different orientations towards computers and technology and mathematics. And, you know, actually, Thomas Murphy made a good point. He messaged me and he said, as some of you guys probably know, Thomas Murphy from Twitter, one of the smartest guys on there. He said, he's like, I like the episode, but he had some contentions. And then he brought up an example of what Simondon said, how he himself wasn't a cybernetician. But that wasn't really what I was getting at. And I just want to sort of clarify that this isn't about cybernetics. This is about what comes after. You know, as Heidegger said, cybernetics ended philosophy. I'm trying to figure out what ended cybernetics, and we're trying to get beyond that. And game theory is one thing that I think we can really sort of touch on. I also want to get into things like economic feedback loops, which I think is a really sort of interesting field of study. And, you know, I think, I don't know if it's Compot or Ed Berg, but they were somebody, I don't know if my source is actually correct on this, but I know, I forget where it was. It was like, I don't know, like something about like Jonathan's Coffee House, which was a 17th century meeting place that there was a lot of sort of contention surrounding the Catholic Church and trying to ban these coffee houses as these kind of like early, it was actually the initial site of, to make a long story short, of the London Stock Exchange. And so what happened was these mergings of kind of like the public sort of subaltern financial sector at that time, which was mainly Protestant, had something to do, like, the more business that was conducted there, the more coffee these coffee houses sold, which just makes absolute sense. So it became a sort of larger economic sub-mercantile or exchange system based on the fact that it was hospitable to the host just in terms of selling more coffee. And it became this kind of like breeding ground for, you know, actual discourse and debate and kind of like intellectual matters. And so I think that's pretty interesting too. And I kind of want to get back into that. But, you know, Simondon, who's seen as a cybernetic philosopher, I've always considered him a process philosopher, which is why I kind of also want to make this distinction as well. Murph actually brought up a Simondon quote. He said, right from the start, cybernetics has accepted what all theories of technology must refuse: a classification of technological objects conducted by means of established criteria and following genera and species, which is basically sort of true. And you see a lot of this with this kind of woolly neo-Kantianism of like people like Reza Nagarastani or, you know, these neo-rationalist, neo-analytic philosophy types. They're just, you know, they're taking, it's a kind of transcendental empiricism to the fact that they're basically just coping really hard at not being able to grasp the numinous exteriority that they want to. And because they're all atheists, they can't even accept that it's actually what they're trying to do. And Murphy made this point as well, is actually very hubristic. Like Leibniz, which I talked about at length in the last episode, was like, oh, can't figure it out. It's time to give it up to God. You know, it's like man upstairs, or you know, say the supreme monad knows best. And I think that's a beautiful way of looking at it as well. So it is, you know, it is really an interesting time, man. I am like fascinated. I'm pumped up at the same time. I love doing these long episodes. They take forever. They're not easy. This stuff is like, maybe it's easy for somebody else. It's not easy for me. You know, a lot of people ask, they're like, those cover things that you do, like those, what are those? Like, those must take forever. Like, those must take a long time. I'm like, no, those take me like 15 to 30 minutes. It's like all this other shit, you know, that takes much longer time. But I kind of wanted to get into a few essays as well. You know, in because cybernetics as like a kind of hokey Reddit sort of tier, like, oh, look at the fucking orange control chair, you know, sort of like retro nostalgia. I don't want to get too fishery, but future nostalgia that it's sort of, you know, I guess you could say attached to. It's very attractive to people who don't want to like advance things, you know? And so I want to sort of, again, I want to talk a little bit, just to vindicate what Yukui's doing with this cybernetic anthology, just also the fact that we just don't have a better name. Like, the name sounds cool, you know? It sounds like a Bruce Sterling, you know, Mirror Shades, like, you know, it's a, like, you know, cyberpunk is a little bit fucking, you know, whatever, steampunky, you know. Like, I try to watch that movie, Cloud Atlas or whatever, by the Wachowskis, and it was just, it was too steampunky. It didn't hold up for me. It's like, there's too many temporalities going on. There's no narrative. It's like, well, this is just like the internet as it is, you know. I feel like a lot of that stuff didn't, the kind of CCRU, let's drop a Nietzsche reference, like, that stuff didn't really hold up because it's just the way things are, you know. It really sort of discounts the kind of vibe and imagery that we can make possible by knowing the outer limits of this kind of, like, I don't know, fictive science fiction, imaginary, whatever, Blade Runner. Like, we could go to other places now. We don't have to be fully invested in the narrative structure of things. Like, vibes are still very important, but we can go a little bit further than that. We could go beyond that. It's all totally cool. So I want to go beyond Weiner. I talked a lot about Gregory Bateson last time, but he actually, also not really a cybernetician, his studies on schizophrenia are really super fascinating, just like his studies on alcoholism were as well, which I did a whole thing on last episode. If you guys want to, you're struggling with alcoholism, you want some kind of, I don't know, I guess you could say a little more like out there explanation of how it functions and how it works, if you're struggling with the big book, check that out. Check out the cybernetics of the alcoholic, for lack of a better term. But Gregory Bateson did some pretty great writing on this stuff. Again, very influential to process philosophy, very influential to people like Deleuze and Guattari. And so we're going to make some shit happen. I feel pretty good about it. So, yeah. And so Bateson called this the double bind theory. And the double bind theory is basically, it's a problem in communication in which individuals or groups receive two or more conflicting messages. So in certain scenarios, it can involve like a child and a son. And these distressing, emotional, sort of volatile situations can only really sort of result in successfully responding to one of the messages while failing to respond to the other, or neglecting that one. So the person responding will automatically be perceived as in the wrong, no matter how they respond. The double bind prevents this person from either resolving the underlying dilemma or opting out of the situation entirely. And we see this problem on X all the fucking time, which is why I can barely stomach using it. It's fucking ridiculous. There's only so much time you can do. Every time you do anything, you have two conflicting fires to put out. Now, this is just basically like, what's the point of even using this? It's like, I don't know, remind people you're still alive? I don't know. So the double bind is basically, it's utilized as a form of control without open coercion. The use of confusion makes it difficult to respond to and also resist. And so a double bind generally includes different levels of abstraction in the order of messages, and these messages can either be stated explicitly or implicitly within the context of the situation, or they can be conveyed by tone or voice or body language. Further complications arise when frequent double binds are part of an ongoing relationship to which the person or group is committed. So the double bind is often misunderstood to be a simple contradictory situation where the subject is trapped by two conflicting demands. While it's true that the core of the double bind is two conflicting demands, the difference lies in how they are imposed upon the subject, what the subject's understanding of the situation is, and who imposes these demands upon the subject. So unlike the unusual no-win situation, the subject has difficulty in defining the exact nature of the paradoxical situation in which they are caught. And this actually sort of ties in with the fact that double binds were introduced into socialist societies like the Soviet Union in mapping out game theory social plans that go sort of beyond a cybernetic model, because cybernetics seeks to streamline the process, which capitalism needs, because capitalism is very dynamic. It has a lot of shifts, and it goes up and it goes down, and it's really fucking crazy. And, you know, there's a lot that can be, you know, there's a creational destruction to it. Not that it really creates anything that great anymore, but that's besides the point. It's constantly moving is basically all I'm saying. So in a socialist society, they needed to introduce these sort of like shocks of schizophrenia to breed innovation so that physicists and scientists could actually have more freedom than the standard citizen to get into various intellectual inquiries, because they needed to be able to like mix it up a bit, or they had no way of competing, because the Soviet Union, like in America, part of mastering your situation is how can I control and leverage my environment to suit me? How can I get what I want? I have all these choices. Everything's laid out for me. I have infinite fucking choices, but how do I get what I want? That's something that is, I think, a little bit different in other civilizations, forms of social organization. The difference here would be that, but in a place like the Soviet Union, there was no option to control your environment. The environment basically controls you. You are streamlined into your surroundings. And the way to gain power is not necessarily through controlling and manipulating, but through subversion and escape. So how can you find these little pockets or areas that you can kind of go into and escape into? Some people did this by, you know, compromat smuggling in stuff like Beatles records through X-rays and shit. You know, like there were other ways to do this, or obtaining consumer goods through friends and family networks, these kind of sub-market networks, which is very common in China. But in China, it's almost like glorified now. They're like, you know, be a communist, start your own, you know, be a part of the part, like start your own business, become a merchant, you know, do these things, just embrace total sort of like outside markets of counterfeit systems. And Anna Greenspan's new book kind of like touches upon this a little bit. Gregory Bateson and his colleagues defined the double bind basically in a set of points. So the situation involves two or more people, one of whom, for the purpose of the definition, is designated as the subject. The others are people who are considered the subject's superiors, so like figures of authority, parents who the subject supposedly respects. Two, repeated experience. The double bind is a recurrent theme in the experience of the subject, and as such cannot be resolved as a single traumatic experience. Three, a primary injunction is imposed on the subject by the others generally in one or two forms. So do X or I will punish you, or do not do X and I will punish you, which is kind of a Calvinist thing. It's just basically any sort of contradictory or like mixed messaging. So in the program, Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families, which is, it's abbreviated as ACA, they talk a lot about stuff like mixed messaging, how that's kind of like a form of trauma induction where one parent says one thing while the other does something different. Like, so for example, say you get caught smoking weed at school and you get sent home and you get punished by your mom, and your mom like hits you over the head with a broom and starts like smacking you with a big wooden spoon and tells you to get out. And then your dad kind of pulls you aside and goes, hey, do you have any weed left? You want to smoke weed with me? That's kind of a form of cognitive induction where one person gives leverage to the other. And it's kind of like a good cop, bad cop thing, which is why it's a common police tactic amongst like sort of like patrol, where one person is like, you know, in the squad car and he's like, plays the bad guy. Then the good guy kind of steps in and then goes, all right, well, maybe we, and so they're sort of leveraging these games. So, and also the punishment may include the withdrawing of love and the expression of hate and anger or abandonment resulting from the authority figure's expression of helplessness. A secondary injunction is imposed on the subject, conflicting with the first at a higher and more abstract level. This is similar to the good cop, bad cop scenario we were sort of looking at just now. So you must do X, but only do it because you want to. So it's giving this kind of false sense of like freedom or autonomy, which it's, you know, it's like a thinly veiled threat. So it's necessary for this injunction to be expressed in this kind of verbal language. And so, if necessary, a tertiary injunction is imposed on the subject to prevent them from escaping the dilemma. So, finally, Bateson states that the complete list of the previous requirements may be unnecessary in the event that the subject is already viewing their world in double bind patterns. And this is the kicker, is the double bind introduces new cognitive patterns into the subject. And so he goes on to give this these characteristics of this relationship. And this is kind of why the double bind model doesn't really, it's not a positive feedback pattern because it's not positive. You know, it's just basically sort of like a chaotic game modeling that's very contingent on the exteriors, whether it's like the motives of the authorities. It's basically like, how can you account for all of this craziness in the world? And so again, this is also why Gregory Bateson is not a cybernetician. So in essence, the double bind is two conflicting demands, each of a different logical level, neither of which can be ignored or escaped. This leaves the subject torn both ways. So whatever demand they try to meet, the other demand can't be met. I must do it, but I can't do it, is a typical description of the double bind experience. Social media is like the ultimate double bind experience. It's like, how can you leave it without actually leaving it? it's a really weird situation, because if you deactivate your X account and you get to a level where you can, where you feel like it's imposing a weight on you that you can no longer handle, you're like, wait, but there's like this Dexter's Lab style guide that was just published that nobody had seen from 1994. And it's like, ooh, I can really use something here. You know, one of my friends publishes some like obscure Eschenmayer translation. I'm like, oh man, I don't want to miss out on that. That's so great. And not just that, it's the fact that your provenance, that your name can be taken over and people can assume your identity and act as you and make up sort of fabrications or something like Whitney Webb. There's like multiple impersonators. Like, gang stalking is fucking real, bro. Like, that shit is real. That it's pretty crazy, but it's very, very real. I don't know how to, we can get into that a different time, but this sort of, these metacommunicative statements are very difficult to meet. So it's like, usually if you're saying on a website, you know, for example, I have a podcast, I'm a musician. Dividing these things up into different personas, it's never going to work for me. You know, like, the load's already been shot. You might as well just say, hey, this is all the same creative energy. I'm just going with the flow. You know, at a certain point, you can't be Mr. Mysterious anymore. Just like you can't sort of like learn mysticism or uncover a certain mystical language. I know Willem Flusser talks a lot about that, about how things like, you know, you're not going to go find some like hidden arcane knowledge, you know, in some like esoteric text that you can't, it's like, no, you actually have to just engage with reality. Mario Tronti talks about this as well. Now, there are things that are spiritual that hold up very, very well. We can turn to those things, like the figure of the church or whatnot. But in terms of like how to meet these demands, it's like exit is a really sort of strange thing. What does it mean to exit? This is on everybody's mind. Everyone I talk to is like, how do I fucking quit this? I'm in a double bind scenario. What do I do? You know? And the answer is always like, you know, just block the stuff you don't like. Don't engage with it. Don't look at it. Like, you just, you can have your real estate without engaging. But again, it's like, it's these feedback, it's these patterns that are created, these schizophrenic, the schizophrenia of the internet just induces these patterns. It's like, because I see shit that makes me mad all the fucking time. You know, bro, like, I'm not above that. Like, when I see some like dipshit making fun of that Aaron Bushnell guy who lit himself on fire, it's like, does it, even if he's not a hero, let's say, which it's been proven, he was one of the people involved in oppositional development systems. So he had very clear knowledge of the tunnels that were being built under Gaza. Like, let's say, like, he just couldn't deal with the stress or horror. Like, let's say he was an anarchist or a communist or whatever. Like, it doesn't fucking matter. The point is, you're engaging with things in this way. You want attention. For what? A lot of these guys, they're, you know, they don't have what it takes to finpunk. They don't have what it takes to do a nano business. They're not good enough. They can't do it. So they go to their job, they take it up, you know, they take it from the man all fucking day. They listen to their boss, they don't step out of line, and then they go home and they, you know, go do their little anonymous internet games. And that's what they do for fun, because they're bitch made and they're pussies, and they cannot finpunk a nano business. They're not good enough. They don't have what it takes. They'll never be able to do it on their own. And at the end of the day, it's like, bro, like, I've been hustling in pawn shops for 12 fucking years doing this shit. Like, this ain't nothing new to me. Fuck. Seriously. So that, but, you know, you don't have to do it through stuff like intellectual production either. there's no rule to this. Like, ownership over your free time and labor, you don't have to be some bohemian artist or a podcaster. There are many ways to skin this cat. It's not about that. Like, it's not about, oh, you got your free time is about being a bohemian. No, it's having a podcast. Like, we all know that podcasting is, you know, a little embarrassing. We all know that. Let's not lie. I'm not going to sit here and lie about that. It's fucking embarrassing. That's why I was talking to my friend the other day, and he goes, I consider you a musician and a writer who happens to have a podcast. So I was like, oh, thanks. I beat the allegations. These monologues, these long form things, also I feel like it's a form of like using the medium while not engaging with it in the same kind of way. Like, new episode drops every Monday. This guest, you're creating this network. It's like, I've already done all that. I don't need to do that anymore. All I need to do is get to the bottom of things the best way that I can so that we don't keep repeating these same fucking mistakes over and over and over again. So we're getting into legal crises now and the double bind's effectiveness, not just on the internet, but also in the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and state action. So a person could be subpoenaed to testify in a federal case and given Fifth Amendment immunity for testimony in that case. However, since the immunity did not apply to a state prosecution, the person could refuse to testify at the federal level despite being given some kind of immunity, thus subjecting the person to imprisonment for contempt of court. So it's like you see this with like witness protection programs and stuff. So the information they were forced to give the federal proceeding could then be used to convict the person in a state proceeding. And the double bind was first introduced in the 1950s. And it was actually in reference to the complexity of communication in the relation to schizophrenia. And Bateson made clear that the complexities are common in normal circumstances, especially in play, humor, poetry, ritual, and fiction. And this goes into the logical types. Now, where does this sound familiar? Play, humor, poetry, ritual, and fiction. Sounds a little bit like network spirituality. It sounds a little bit like anonymous stuff and memes and lore and self-mythology. And can you stack up to this in real life? No. So essentially what you're doing is you're creating a double bind system where your fictive internet persona or your artistic persona, it doesn't stack up with how you are in real life. This is why I see a lot of like milquetoasts and whatnot just kind of like parroting these idiotic things without realizing that they're basically essentially giving themselves schizophrenia. And that's not a good thing. Like, that is not a healthy way to live. So we're going to figure this out. And so Bateson made clear that such complexities are common in normal circumstances, especially in these modes. But also, these things are necessary in overtly streamlined systems, which we'll get to later. So Bateson's findings indicated that tangles in communication, often diagnosed as schizophrenia, are not necessarily the result of an organic brain dysfunction. Instead, they found that destructive double binds were a frequent pattern of communication amongst families and patients. And they proposed that growing up amidst perpetual double binds could lead to learned patterns of confusion in thinking and communication. This is really sort of important, I think, when it comes to like schizoposting stuff or, you know, cosplaying as schizophrenic. You sort of become or engender the schizophrenic. And so in some cases, this is necessary. I think when the world is kind of locked down, it's a way to sort of inject like intellectual vitalism into the world instead of, you know, because well, a lot of these cyberneticians, they kind of fashion themselves as like impresarios of self-correcting trajectories, but these self-correcting trajectories were already there. So like Weiner, even though he was very influential to people like Claude Shannon and von Neumann and some of the more complex engineers and people who were doing sort of, you could say, shape rotating, it was kind of like there's a political dimension to this, but otherwise it's not like that super important. So we're not really talking about Norbert Weiner a lot. And I haven't, which is kind of why we sort of left him out of the last episode, which was focused mostly on people like Bateson, Simondon, and Leibniz. And human communication is complex. And so the context plays a very vital role into this. And communication consists of words, tones, voice, body language, and relates to what has been said in the past, not just by people who are saying it, but by people who have nothing to do with the circumstance at hand. They play a role in the environment or the congruity of the environment that these situations or complexities take place in. So conflicts in communication are common, and often the individuals ask, like, what do you mean, or they seek clarification. And so that's a kind of meta-communication, which is communication about the communication. You see a lot of this in guys like Nathan Fielder, in stuff like The Rehearsal. It's like this hyper-self-awareness that you're an actor and you're on TV. And the term was brought into prominence by Gregory Bateson when he expanded to all exchanged cues and propositions about A, codification, and B, relationship between the communicators. Metacommunication may or may not be congruent with or supportive of or contradictory to that verbal communication. So he suggested the significance of metacommunication all the way back in 1951 and then elaborated upon one particular variation, the message, "This is play," in 1956. A critical fact about Bateson was that every message could have a metacommunicative element, and typically each message held metacommunicative information about how to interpret other messages. So he saw no distinction in the type of message, only a distinction in function. Some metacommunicative signals are nonverbal, and this refers to body motion communication, which is occasionally employed by Bateson and was first used in 1952 by Ray Birdwhistle, an anthropologist who wished to study how people communicate through posture, gesture, stance, and movement. And so part of Birdwhistle's work involved filming people in social situations and analyzing them to show different levels of communication not clearly seen otherwise. This is, again, Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal, which is kind of why I'm anti-Nathan Fielder, because like he kind of sees himself as this impresario of like this deep study of social relations. All these things have been going on for like a century, basically. So when you see these kind of sick fantasies being played out as some kind of like meta commentary, it doesn't really resemble anything different than that of a dysfunctional family. So the classic example of a negative double bind is a mother telling her child that she loves them while at the same time turning away in disgust or inflicting corporal punishment as discipline. So the words are socially acceptable, but the body language is in conflict with it. The child does not know how to respond to the conflict between the words and the body language, and because the child is dependent on the mother for basic needs, they are in a sort of a quandary. And Small children have difficulty articulating contradictions verbally and can neither ignore them nor leave the relationship because they're dependent on the parent. They have no autonomy whatsoever. And we're going to sort of look into this and how it fits into the Soviet model of socialization and economics as well. Another example is when one is told to be spontaneous. So the very command contradicts spontaneity, but it only becomes a double bind when one can neither ignore the command nor comment on the contradiction. Often the contradiction in communication is not apparent to bystanders unfamiliar with previous communications. So you see this a lot, right? You see people, there's only so many different ways you can like describe a problem while you're sort of in the problem and it not gets you out of the problem or the quandary. This is the biggest issue I see with like media criticism today in general. Another example is like a boss saying something like, I suggest you find someone who is you feel is more capable in this role. So this requires the recipient to either confirm that the current incumbent in the role is sufficiently capable or accept they choose someone else based on their feelings, not really an objective assessment of whether the incumbent is capable, which is why this whole like thing of say how you feel instead of stating it an objective fact, I think is kind of a form of psychological warfare because you're weaponizing your feelings against somebody instead of just like actually doing the thing and just breaking it off. I almost feel like silence is the best way to end a situation. You know, just give your Irish goodbye or just kind of like dip out. Don't make a big deal of things. That's a really good strategy when you see things just turn really grotesque. Just kind of like disengage. You don't have to. I made this mistake recently where I was like, nope, this is all too gross. But by saying that, I'm still locked within that contradiction, and that can be sort of problematic as well. Another example, and this is a little bit morbid, but this notion, a very classic example of the double bind relationship is grooming. Now, grooming discourse, I think, is a little bit it's a little bit strange. Can you groom a 25-year-old? Can a 50-year-old do that? Let's not get into stuff like that. People are adults. I just want to preface that. A lot of times it's so overshot, like a 50-year-old can't date a 22-year-old when that person's legally an adult. Like, sure, everybody, we all influence each other. Relationships are messy and complicated. I'm talking like teenagers, like when you get into that level, it's a little bit different. A lot of times abusers start double bind relationships by grooming, giving little concessions or gifts or privileges. And then the primary injunction is you should like what you're getting from me. And when the child begins to go along, then the interaction goes to the next level and all these victimizations occur. And so a secondary injunction is like, I'm punishing you for whatever reason they're coming up with because you were bad, naughty, messy, or because you deserve it. You see a lot of this with like blackmail, for example. And then they'll say, well, you made me do it because you were not obeying me, which automatically sort of dictates this kind of like authority to some like big other, for lack of a better term. And so one possibility to escape double binds is to realize that certain people only antagonize you to make you feel a certain way. Like they know that it makes you feel anxious. It's a conditioned reflex that they repeat over and over again. So if somebody isn't bothered by their punishment, they might not be bothered at all. And so you could leave the situation entirely, which means that you avoid, it's just total avoidance. So you can't claim to be gaslit if you're not present. You can't claim to be bothered if you're not there. So another solution is maintain your existence, but don't engage. You know, they call this in like the field of whatever, you know, I know it's like fucking middling e-girls lighting their right-wing cigarettes on DSM-5 books or whatever is like a thing. But, you know, there's some real stuff in there, and you might want to check that out before you start making fun of this shit. So you can't be scapegoated if you're just not there. If you're just, you just have to give a kind of distance. And it's hard, you know, because I think as verbal people, as quote-unquote word cells or whatever, like, we want to give our opinions. We want to feel like our opinions matter and we can get into sort of public forums. But it quickly devolves into a double-bind situation or paradigm. And this is kind of why, like, Elon Musk Twitter is like, I just call it the double-bind paradigm. A lot of people call it Elon slop because certain behaviors are rewarded and they're not very smart. Like, let's not get into like, you know, woke shit or like cancel-y stuff. It's just, these people are fucking idiots. End of discussion. It's kind of interesting when somebody who is so engaged with social, with like engineering, tries to enter the socius. They have no idea what's going on. They're like commenting on memes that are 10 years old. They're like just completely fucking out of the loop. And so it's really weird. But Bateson, who weirdly enough did stuff with Alan Watts and had some interest in like hokey forms of New Age Buddhism, although I think Alan Watts gets an unfair rap. I think he's a lot better than people say he is. Granted, he's not perfect or anything, but he's not that bad. So Bateson also described positive double binds, and he related this to Zen Buddhism on a path to spiritual growth. And so the use of these therapeutic double binds by psychiatrists, where you're forced to confront contradictions in your life in a way that help you heal. So one of Bateson's consultants, which is a guy, Milton H. Erickson, he was an American psychiatrist and psychologist, and he specialized in hypnosis and stuff like family therapy. Now, you know, therapy and psychology, I think, is a little bit fake. I don't think it's really that real. I think there are much more important things than, because this leads to this also a positive addiction with healing the self. And I think that can be a big problem too, because you're still fixated on your problems. You're still fixated on yourself, which is why I don't think that's a great solution either. But it's interesting because double binds are the loss of feedback systems. And there's an amazing essay, actually. By Slava Gerovich, who lived during the Soviet Union, called Cybernetics Across Cultures, the Localization of the Universal. And he gets into this, I think, really succinctly in the fact that double binds were introduced to break up feedback systems in a socialist society, because the Soviet Union was so streamlined. There really wasn't the same level of autonomy. You know, like in liberal capitalism, we need these processes so that things don't just go fly off the handles. But in a culture like Russia, and you even trace this back to stuff like Russian cosmism, there needed to be like an injunction of schizophrenia. You know, like it needed these shocks in order to advance and actually compete with capitalist countries, especially during the Cold War. So I think this is a very sort of interesting thing. And he gets really sort of into the double bind theory, stuff like learned helplessness stuff. So The history of cybernetics is a story of crossing cultural, political, and disciplinary boundaries. Cybernetics, or the science of control and communication in the animal and the machine, was articulated in the 1948 book of the same title by professor of mathematics at MIT, Norbert Wiener. Not surprising. So a display of Wiener's historical photographs and documents is placed in the hall of the MIT Mathematics Department, and Slava Gurevich, he teaches at MIT. So his work draws on this wartime research on anti-aircraft gun control, and he designed and built an aircraft predictor, a feedback-operated servomechanical device for predicting the trajectory of an enemy airplane. This function was usually performed by human gun pointers and gun trainers, and his device would therefore usurp a specifically human function. Now, again, this is like branding stuff. Wiener was not the first person to ever do this. Leibniz did this hundreds of years before him. The Egyptian water valve pump was the first mechanical, supposedly the first mechanical feedback mechanism. Like, he's not the first person to do this, but he gets a lot of credit for it. Same with Stafford Beer. And I think a lot of that had to do with their influence on the political sphere, as well as guys like Hayek and Milton Friedman. So combining terms from social engineering and which is feedback, and psychology, and also philosophy, again, he branded himself because of his adjacency to philosophy. Same with guys like Hans von Forrester. But the second order cybernetics guys, again, they didn't really do a whole lot. We got to go deeper. In order to figure this out, we have to go a little bit deeper than this. So one thing that he did do was he further generalized these ideas and tried to introduce a new quote-unquote universal language, which actually Slava Gurevich calls cyberspeak. It ties together a diverse set of human-machine metaphors. Cutting across various disciplines, computing, information theory, control theory, neurophysiology, and sociology, cybernetics describe living organisms, control, and communication devices and human society in the same cybernetic terms: information, feedback, and control. And here's where the history kind of gets interesting, though. So both American and Soviet scientists believe that there existed a general, universal, ahistorical mechanism of human thought. Yet, as these scientists themselves belonged to different cultures, they had distinct, culturally specific institutions about human thinking. The humans, who they took as universal categories, were, in fact, people who belonged to specific cultures. Their AI models thus reflected the specificity of their cultures. Which is kind of interesting because AI now is like this monoculture of hype. It doesn't really have a real cultural value system. I don't know if that's just as the world has become more globalized. It just seems to me, at least what I'm seeing in the West, it's very, I don't know, it just seems very sort of like hegemonic in a way. So everyday practice in the USA and the USSR. So everyday practice in any society is based on commonly accepted patterns of behavior, actions perceived as typical and normal, and also on various strategies of handling daily situations, known as common sense. John McCarthy famously called AI systems programs with common sense, implying that a fundamentally universal common sense knowledge underlines human thinking. As the anthropologist Clifford Geertz suggested, however, common sense is historically constructed and subjected to historically defined standards of judgment. This is what all structural anthropologists have said. Claude Levi-Strauss, you name it. So it can vary dramatically from one people to the next. It is, in short, a cultural system. And Geertz warned against the sketching out some logical structure that always takes, for there is none. And so this is, again, one of the pitfalls of cybernetics as a field of study. So unfortunately, it undermines McCarthy's basic premise. Everyday practice serves as a mediator for the constant exchange of cultural symbols and shapes the cultural vocabulary of any given group. For Americans during this period, everyday experiences ranged from reading the New York Times to watching political debates on television to shopping at supermarkets that stocked a great variety of products. Soviet people's everyday experience looked quite a bit different, which is obvious. They had never read the New York Times, never watched political debates. They never had a problem choosing which brand to buy because there weren't very many brands to buy. They read Pravda and underground literature, sat at party meetings, and stood in lines at food stores. What seemed typical and normal to them looked peculiar and exotic to Americans, and vice versa. Yet, if common sense is not universal, AI models do tell us something, if not about the fundamentals of human thinking in general, then perhaps about specific cultural constructions of common knowledge. Cultural influence manifests itself not only through typical patterns of behavior and strategies of everyday life, but also through language, via the metaphors by which we live and think, including thinking about thought itself. Meta-thought, meta-commentary. This is another thread here. So basically what he's trying to do is he's discussing the different cultural metaphors and metrics of thought prevalent amongst American and Soviet intellectuals and how they sort of deepen connections with specific AI systems. So he argues that there are basically these deep cultural factors that lie beneath considerable differences in the approaches to AI developed by these scholars. And while looking for general principles of thinking and behavior, AI specialists actually implemented their own cultural stereotypes into their models themselves. So if you consider an everyday situation like shopping, the main problem for American customers is how to make the right choice because there are so many choices. And there's such an appealing variety of foods and goods. Like when I know people who've come from other countries, even a place like Japan, they come here and they stay here and they're like, oh, I can't stop eating. And you're like, why? It's like, because there's so much food everywhere. And it's not even that it's better quality because the food in Japan is much higher quality than it is here. It's like, we just have so many choices. My grandpa used to say about political candidates, he said it was like Baskin and Robbins, you know, you had so many choices, but all of them suck. He would kind of say that. And so it's the same thing for college courses. You can choose anything you want, the most useless academic vocations. You have full choice. In the Soviet Union, you definitely didn't have that choice. And while things have liberalized across the globe, the way in which technology had developed along these historical and cultural lines very much dictates how we engage with these technologies now. So in the Soviet Union, obviously nobody had any choice. The only choice students had was in their selected preferred athletic activities. And so multiple choice tests were even rare. Instead, the student was required to spell out all the intermediate steps, and if the algorithm was inefficient or simply different from the one in the textbook, the grade was lowered even if the answer was correct. Election ballots always included only a single candidate to simplify political choices. And so finally, the problem was not what to choose, but how to find anything at all. With a shortage of many foods and household items, sought-after products could be obtained only via back channels. So there was this whole underground network or market, or shazai, which is what they call it in China. So basically, they had to create these like unique, informal social interactions through friends, relatives, friends of relatives and relatives of friends so that the desired washing machine or a television set could be found on the other end. Cognitive psychological theories developed by American and Soviet scholars reflected the different cultural values of choice and creativity. The American cognitive psychologist Jerome Bruner, for example, described concept attainment as a process whose every step can be usually regarded as a choice or decision between alternative steps. And so Bruner's work showcased the cognitive revolution in psychology, which closely associated the work of American AI pioneers Herbert Simon and Alan Newell. And in contrast, the Soviet psychologist Andrei Brushlinsky rejected the idea that thinking involved a choice amongst pre-existing alternatives. He argued that true thinking must produce a new alternative. Actual live thinking, for example, solving a task or a problem, always takes the form of prediction of an initially unknown future solution. This prediction makes an act of choosing amongst alternative solutions unnecessary, which I think is pretty fucking based, honestly. So the AI specialists in the Soviet Union, United States, they sometimes drew on psychological theories and sometimes AI models. More habitually, however, AI specialists ignored psychologist findings, believing that knowledge should flow from AI to psychology and not the other way around. When AI and psychology agreed, this often happened because they both relied on the same cultural stereotypes. And here we get into a really good part. And this is bureaucratic man and striving for control of the social environment and the different ways different cultures attain social control or control of their social environments. Bureaucratic man, striving for control of the social environment.